Good evening. Thanks for coming. My name is Hisham Ashar. I'm with the local Amnesty International group in Charlottesville. I'd like to thank you for coming here for this presentation tonight. The use of drones is becoming more and more widespread, and there's a lot of issues related to this topic, local, national, international, war and peace, privacy, you name it. Before I introduce our special guest, the moderator of the event is Dr. Bill Anderson. I'm going to introduce him. Dr. Anderson is a local peace activist. He's the chair of the Charlottesville Peace and Justice, Center for Peace and Justice. He's been over the 15 missions all over the world and for peace. He's a retired faculty from the University of Virginia. As you know, Amnesty International is a human rights group that's been working for more than 50 years. Our most interest in this local group is prisoners of conscience. So if you like to work on people who are detained illegally or lawfully for a simple expression of their opinion, just like we do right now here, please join us. We meet every month, and we work on a lot of activities that relates to human rights. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Anderson.
Thank you so much. It's really an honor and a pleasure to welcome you to this event on behalf of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and the Festival of the Book. And I'm sure that most of you have gotten this brochure, which you can get down at the Omni and some other stores on the mall, like the New Dominion Bookstop. We've got such a wonderful set of programs here today. What's wrong? You can't hear me? You need to mic me. No, people can't hear?
It just has to be in front of you.
Okay. All right. Technical difficulties. Is this right? Is this the one? Okay. No, that's not the one. This is the one? Oh, both of them, okay. I'll sit right in front of them. we really want to thank you for coming out for this event, which is a very timely and very interesting. I want to ask you all to please silence your cell phones. I've got one that has a very irritating ring. So turn any kind of cell phones or other electronic devices, turn them off now at this time. I want to encourage you to tweet to others about the event at hashtag V-A-Book2016. I really want to thank Hisham Ashar and the Amnesty International for bringing Ms. Cohn here. And I really want to thank Ms. Cohn for coming. I want to ask you also to remember to support the Festival of the Book. It's free of charge, but not of cost. And you can either go online to give a gift of support, or you can make a contribution by picking up an envelope, which these envelopes are available down at the Omni. At the end, I'll remind you to please give an evaluation, because that also helps to strengthen the festival of the book, and it will help it to endure. Those two things, the contribution and your evaluation, will help it to endure for years to come. The topic for discussion today, as I said, is by Ms. Cohn, and she's going to talk about her book, Drones and Targeted Killing. Ms. Cohn is a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. And she's the author of several other books, which are related and which are very fascinating books. Among those are Cowboy Republic, Six Ways, The Bush Gang Has Defied the Law, Rules of Disengagement, The Politics of Honor and Military Dissent. And she's the editor of another volume entitled U.S. and Torture, Interrogations, Incarceration, and Abuse. Today's book is really interesting. It starts off with a very interesting foreword by Archbishop Tutu. And in it, he asks the question, he talks about the problem of drones and how the valuable contribution that Ms. Cohn has made in editing this book and bringing together a number of authors. But he says a very interesting thing that I thought we should ask ourselves. He did this in an article that he wrote in the New York Times. He says, do the United States and its people really want to tell those of us who live in the rest of the world that our lives are not the same, of the same value as yours? That President Obama can sign off on a decision to kill us with less worry about judicial scrutiny than if the target is an American? Would your Supreme Court, he asked, really want to tell humankind that we, like the slave Dred Scott in the 19th century, are not as human as you are? I cannot believe it, he says. I hope that his disbelief is really true, that we won't tolerate this, that we will find ways to resist. But now I'd like to introduce Ms. Cohn and have her say some things about this really, really interesting book, which I found to be very revealing.
I want to thank Amnesty International Charlottesville chapter and Hisham for inviting me and Bill for his very nice introduction, and I thank you all for coming. I'm delighted to be here. In his 2009 acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize, President Barack Obama declared, where force, and I'm going to go like this when I quote, where force is necessary, we have a moral and strategic interest in binding ourselves to certain rules of conduct. And even as we confront a vicious adversary that abides by no rules, I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war. By the time Obama accepted the award, 1 year into his presidency, he had ordered more drone strikes than George W. Bush had authorized during his two presidential terms. The Bush administration detained and tortured suspected terrorists. The Obama administration has chosen to illegally assassinate them, often with the use of drones. The continued indefinite detention of men at Guantanamo belies Obama's pledge 2 days after his first inauguration to close the prison camp there. However, Obama has added only one detainee to the Guantanamo roster. This government has decided that instead of detaining members of al-Qaeda at Guantanamo, they are going to kill them, according to John Bellinger, who formulated the Bush administration drone policy. On Terror Tuesdays, Obama and John Brennan, his former counterterrorism advisor, now CIA director, go through the kill list to identify which individuals should be assassinated that week. Obama orders two different types of drone strikes, personality strikes, which target named high-value terrorists, and signature strikes, which target training camps and suspicious compounds in areas controlled by militants. And we often see in newspapers like the New York Times, a U.S. drone strike killed 4 militants, or 10 militants, or 12 militants. Not sure what a militant looks like. In the signature strikes, sometimes called crowd killings, the Obama administration often doesn't even know who it's killing. But, write Joe Becker and Scott Shane in the New York Times, some State Department officials have complained to the White House that the criteria used by the CIA sees three guys doing jumping jacks. I'm sorry, the signature for identifying a terrorist signature were too lax. The joke was that when the CIA sees three guys doing jumping jacks, the agency thinks it's a terrorist training camp. Men loading a truck with fertilizer could be bomb makers, but they also might be farmers. As the news broke on March 7th, 2016, that U.S. drone strikes had killed 150 people in Somalia, the White House announced it will reveal for the first time the number of people killed by drones and manned airstrikes outside areas of active hostilities since 2009. The tallies will include civilian deaths. This is a critical first step toward much-needed transparency, but it will not go far enough. The Obama administration has been lying for years about how many deaths result from its drone strikes and manned bombers. In 2011, John Brennan falsely claimed that no civilians had been killed in drone strikes in nearly a year. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which, and this is an anthology, a collection, one of the chapters is written by a person from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is a premier organization, non-governmental organization, that tallies civilian casualties from drone strikes. They're based in London. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism and other non-governmental organizations that calculate drone deaths put the lie to Brennan's claim. It is believed that of the estimated 5,000 people killed on Obama's watch, approximately 1,000 were civilians. But the administration has never released complete casualty figures. Plus, the numbers by themselves are not sufficient. Even if the White House makes good on its promise to publicize death tallies, it must also publish the presidential policy guidance, which has provided the legal justification for the U.S. targeted killing program. In May 2013, responding to international criticism about men starving themselves to death at Guantanamo and his drone policy, Obama delivered a speech at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. He proclaimed, "America does not take strikes when we have the ability to capture individual terrorists. Our preference is always to detain, interrogate, and prosecute them." Then why has he added only one man to Guantanamo during his tenure? As he gave his 2013 speech, the White House released a fact sheet that purported to contain preconditions for the use of lethal force outside areas of active hostilities. But the presidential policy guidance on which the fact sheet was based remains classified. So what does the fact sheet say? First, there must be a legal basis for the use of lethal force. It does not define whether legal basis means complying with ratified treaties. And when the United States ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law, domestic law, under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which says treaties shall be the supreme law of the land. These treaties include the United Nations Charter, which prohibits the use of military force except in self-defense or when approved by the Security Council. It also includes the Geneva Conventions, which prohibits the targeting of civilians, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which guarantees due process and the right to life. The administration justifies its drone strikes by reference to the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, or the AUMF, that Congress gave George W. Bush after the 9/11 attacks. That AUMF authorizes only the targeting of al-Qaeda and affiliated forces. But in Somalia, The 150 people killed, according to the administration, were from al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab didn't even exist in 2001 when the AUMF was enacted. And al-Shabaab had nothing to do with 9/11. The administration says that the people killed, the 150 people killed in Somalia, were terrorists and militants and members of this group, al-Shabaab, but provided no evidence to support that assertion. The dead fighters were assembled for what American officials believe was a graduation ceremony and a prelude to an imminent attack against Americans. I guess that's what people do before they mount an imminent attack. They go to graduation ceremonies. Secondly, and back to the fact sheet requirements, the target must pose a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons. The fact sheet does not define continuing or imminent, but a U.S. Department of Justice white paper that was leaked in 2013 says that a U.S. citizen can be killed even where there is no clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future. So you wonder, what does imminent mean? And presumably, the administration sets an even lower bar for non-citizens. Third, there must be near certainty that the terrorist target is present. But the fact sheet doesn't address the signature strikes, where the Obama administration doesn't even target individuals, but rather areas of suspicious activity. Fourth, there must be near certainty that non-combatants will not be injured or killed. But the administration defines combatants as all men of military age in a strike zone unless there is explicit intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. Five, there must be an assessment that capture is not feasible at the time of the operation. And I don't like the word capture. Animals are captured. People are apprehended, but nevertheless, we'll use their terminology. An assessment that capture is not feasible at the time of the operation. It is unclear what feasibility means. The Department of Justice white paper seems to indicate that infeasible means inconvenient. And it was feasible to capture Osama bin Laden, who was not armed at the time that the U.S. military assassinated him. Now, I just want to diverge for a moment and talk about this idea that people have that, well, Osama bin Laden was this evil man. It's a good thing we took him out. You know, let's forget about due process. After World War II and the Holocaust, the leaders of the victorious powers got together to decide what to do with the Nazi leaders. And Winston Churchill said, just take them out and shoot them. But to his credit, Justice Robert Jackson, who took a leave from the Superior Court to be the chief U.S. prosecutor at Nuremberg, said no. If we don't provide due process even to the Nazi leaders, we will pass a poisoned chalice to future generations. Well, my feeling is that if due process is good enough for the Nazi leaders, it would have been good enough for Osama bin Laden. Number six. There must be an assessment that relevant governmental authorities in the country where action is contemplated cannot or will not effectively address the threat to U.S. persons, which is left undefined. And seven, there must be an assessment that no other reasonable alternatives exist to address the threat to U.S. persons, also left undefined. Finally, the fact sheet would excuse all of these preconditions when the president takes action in extraordinary circumstances, which are both lawful and necessary to protect the United States and its allies. There is no definition of extraordinary circumstances or what would be lawful. Releasing the presidential policy guidance, declassifying it, would clarify the gaps in the guidelines for the use of lethal force listed in the fact sheet. In February 2016, the bipartisan Stimson Task Force on U.S. drone policy gave the Obama administration an F in three areas the task force had flagged for improvement in its June 2014 report. The first area is focused on the progress in releasing information on drone strikes. The second involves explaining the legal basis under U.S. and international law for the drone program. The third is about developing more robust oversight and accountability mechanisms for targeted strikes outside traditional battlefields. Regarding the first area, releasing information, Stimson concluded that the administration has made almost no information public about the approximate number, location, or death tolls of lethal drone attacks, which agency is responsible for what strikes, the CIA or the military. The organizational affiliation of people known to have been killed by strikes, and the number and identities of civilians who are known to have been killed. Speaking about the second area of focus, the legal basis for the drone program, Stimson mentioned that a few governmental documents have been made public that relate to the U.S. lethal drone program, primarily as a result of court orders. One was a redacted, and that means edited, black lines through much of it, a redacted memo from the Department of Justice about the legality of the 2011 targeted killing of U.S. citizen Anwar Awlaki without due process of law. This followed a successful ACLU New York Times Freedom of Information Act request. The other released document was the Department of Defense's Law of War Manual, with three short sections on the use of remotely piloted aircraft in war. The only qualifications it contained was that the weapons cannot be inherently indiscriminate or calculated to cause superfluous injury. But the Geneva Conventions prohibit the targeting of civilians in all instances. Regarding the third area, oversight and accountability, the Stimson report said that the administration continues to oppose the release of any public information on the lethal drone program, which has obstructed mechanisms for greater oversight and accountability. The lack of action reinforces the culture of secrecy surrounding the use of armed drones, according to the report. The Stimson report noted that the administration has, as a rule, been reluctant to publicly acknowledge the use of lethal force by unmanned aerial vehicles in foreign countries. Stimson identified one notable exception, however. After the discovery that two Westerners who were held by al-Qaeda had been killed by a U.S. drone strike in January of 2015, the administration admitted the deaths but provided few specific details. Note that they were Westerners who were killed. And I want to just say that when we hear about ISIS beheading someone, we are justifiably outraged. Of course, we don't hear about Saudi Arabia, one of our closest allies, beheading people on an almost daily basis. But we don't hear about or see the images of the babies whose limbs are strewn about after they're killed with drone strikes. And interestingly, one of the essays in this book, the only one that's been reprinted from elsewhere, was called The Predator War. It was a 2009 piece in The New Yorker by Jane Mayer, and it was the first comprehensive report on the drone program. And Jane Mayer interviewed former CIA lawyer Vicki Duvall, who now teaches at the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis. And this was back in 2009. Vicki Duvall told Jane Mayer, "People are a lot more comfortable with a predator drone strike that kills many people than with a throat slitting that kills one." Vicki Duvall was prescient. Lethal drone strikes have been reported in Yemen, Pakistan, Libya, Afghanistan, and Somalia, and against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. The Stimson report identified 12 countries believed to host U.S. drone bases. They include Afghanistan, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kuwait, Niger, the Philippines, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Seychelles, Turkey, the United Emirates, and Yemen. Former CIA Director Michael Hayden mounted a full-throated defense of the U.S. drone program in a February 2016 New York Times op-ed. Hayden claimed, The targeted killing program has been the most precise and effective application of firepower in the history of armed conflict, annihilating the ranks of Al-Qaeda. But his claims are impossible to verify without documentation. Hayden also said, "We kill people based on metadata." You've probably heard about metadata when Edward Snowden, famous whistleblower, revealed that the National Security Agency, the NSA, was collecting metadata on all of us, and that is the phone calls we make, the sites we visit, the emails we make, metadata. They're supposedly not reading or listening to the content, but just looking at this metadata. So Hayden said, quote, "We kill people based on metadata." But Ars Technica recently revealed that the NSA's Skynet program, which uses an algorithm to gather metadata in order to identify and target terrorist suspects in Pakistan, Somalia, and Afghanistan, would result in 99,000 false positives. So what happens is that they target a cell phone believed to be carried by a terrorist. Let's say he gives it to his mother. She's the one who gets killed based upon this metadata. Obama said in an interview in The Atlantic recently that he has no second thoughts about the drone strikes in the Middle East. Armed drones are operated by pilots located thousands of miles from their targets. How many of you saw the film Good Kill? Do you know who's in that film? January Jones and Ethan Hawke. Two very famous popular actors, and yet it never made it into the major theaters. I saw it in a tiny little venue in San Diego. Good Kill refers to what people sitting in the little trailer outside of Las Vegas in the military say after one of the pilots presses the button that drops the missile and kills people, and then they say, "Good kill." And it traces, Ethan Hawke plays a drone operator who, even though he's thousands of miles from his target and can go home to his family every night in the suburbs of Las Vegas, he develops post-traumatic stress disorder from what he is doing. You can see pictures of the strike zone. And between the time that the button is pushed to release the missile and the missile deploys, it takes 10 seconds. Meanwhile, a woman and child walk in to the strike zone. And after doing this enough times, he got very, very ill. I wonder if that had anything to do with why it never made it into the big theaters. Before launching its payload, the drone hovers above the area. It emits a buzzing sound that terrorizes communities. "The drones were terrifying," observed New York Times journalist David Rohde, who was captured by the Taliban in Afghanistan in 2008 and later escaped. "From the ground, it is impossible to determine who or what they are tracking as they circle overhead. The buzz of a distant propeller is a constant reminder of imminent death. Drones fire missiles that travel faster than the speed of sound. A drone's victim never hears the missile that kills him." After the drone drops a bomb on its target, a second strike often bombs people, rescuing the wounded from the first strike. And that's called a double tap. And frequently, a third strike targets mourners at funerals for those felled by prior strikes. Really should be called a triple tap. U.S. drones have killed children, rescuers, and funeral processions on multiple occasions, according to the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council on Foreign Relations also reports that the vast majority were neither Al-Qaeda nor Taliban leaders. Instead, most were low-level, anonymous, suspected militants who were predominantly engaged in insurgent or terrorist operations against their governments rather than in active international terrorist plots. Drones are Obama's weapon of choice because, unlike piloted fighter aircraft, they don't jeopardize the lives of U.S. pilots. There are claims that the use of drones results in fewer civilian casualties than manned bombers. However, a study based on classified military data conducted by the Center for Naval Analyses and the Center for Civilians in Conflict found that the use of drones in Afghanistan has caused 10 times more civilian deaths than manned fighter aircraft. In the United States, the dominant narrative about the use of drones in Pakistan is of a surgically precise and effective tool that makes the U.S. safer by enabling targeted killing of terrorists with minimal downsides or collateral impacts. This narrative is false. According to the comprehensive report Living Under Drones, issued by Stanford Law School and NYU Law School. Many killed by drones are civilians, or in the administration's parlance, bug splat, referring to the collateral damage estimate methodology the U.S. military and the CIA employ. Targeted killing with drones is counterproductive. General Stanley McChrystal, architect of the U.S. counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan, declared that drones are hated on a visceral level and contribute to a perception of American arrogance. Kurt Volker, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, concurs. Drone strikes do not solve our terrorist problem. In fact, drone use may prolong it. Even though there is no immediate retaliation, in the long run, the contributions to radicalization through drone use may put more Americans at risk. Mullah Sabara, a southern tribal sheikh from Yemen, told the journalist Jeremy Scahill, "The U.S. sees al-Qaeda as terrorism, and we consider the drones terrorism. The drones are flying day and night, frightening women and children, disturbing sleeping people. This is terrorism," he said. The Council on Foreign Relations reported a strong correlation in Yemen between stepped-up targeted killings since December 20, 2009 and heightened anger toward the United States and sympathy with or allegiance to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Drone strikes breed increased resentment against the United States and lead to the recruitment of more terrorists. Drones have replaced Guantanamo as the recruiting tool of choice for militants, according to the New York Times' Becker and Shane. They quoted Faisal Shassad, who, while pleading guilty to trying to detonate a bomb in Times Square, told the judge, "When the drones hit, they don't see children." Jeremy Scahill writes, "The secret war in Pakistan became largely a drone bombing campaign, described by CIA officers at the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad as boys with toys. By the end of Obama's first year as president, he and his new counterterrorism team would begin building the infrastructure for a formalized U.S. assassination program, with an aggressive embrace of assassination as a centerpiece of U.S. security policy." The United States uses two types of armed drones, the Predator, which costs $4.5 million each, and the Reaper, valued at $15 million, both produced by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems in San Diego. And since I live in San Diego, I feel that I qualify as an expert on drones because that's where they are manufactured. The Reaper houses up to 4 Hellfire missiles and 2 500-pound bombs. It can fly to heights of 21,000 feet for up to 22 hours. Its cameras enable the pilots operating the drone 7,500 miles away to see the faces of their targets on the computer screen as the bomb hits. Tom Dispatch has identified 60 bases used in U.S. drone operations, although there could be more, as there is a cloak of secrecy surrounding the drone warfare program. The drone industry doesn't like to refer to their killer robots as drones because of the negative connotation of these machines droning above communities. They prefer to call them UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles. And an interesting story is that on the Amazon page for my book, there is room for comments. So if any of you read the book and you want to comment, feel free. And one of those, actually 4 of those comments, were from people who work for Northrop Grumman, who manufacture the Global Hawk. And the first comment with which the other three agreed, said, how can you believe anything she writes in that book because the picture on the front cover is a global hawk, which is a surveillance drone. It's not a killer drone. Now, the book also has a chapter on surveillance drones. And so I found a quote from a researcher from Columbia who referred to the global hawk as drones, because he said, by the way, the global hawk is not a drone. It's not a drone. And yet they're referred to by experts as drones. And then the other three chimed in. But they don't like to refer to them as drones. Targeted killing, which is really the death penalty without due process, is an example of American exceptionalism, reflecting the view that people in the United States are somehow superior to those in other countries. In his 2013 speech to the UN General Assembly and his State of the Union addresses, specifically to the General Assembly, Obama stated, "Some may disagree, but I believe that America is exceptional, in part because we have shown a willingness through the sacrifice of blood and treasure to stand up not only for our own narrow self-interest, but for the interests of all. But in addition to the U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, hundreds of thousands of people in those countries have been killed and untold numbers wounded." Time columnist Joe Klein, considered by many to be a liberal, bought into American exceptionalism in a disturbing way in a 2012 interview by Joe Scarborough on MSNBC's Morning Joe. Scarborough observed, "You have four-year-old girls being blown to bits because we have a policy that says, you know what, instead of trying to go in, take the risk, get the terrorists out of hiding, we're just going to blow up everyone around them." And he mentioned collateral damage. Joe Klein retorted, "The bottom line in the end is, whose four-year-old gets killed? What we're doing is limiting the possibility that four-year-olds here are going to get killed by indiscriminate acts of terror. So it's preferable that foreign little girls get killed in order to protect American little girls." American exceptionalism also reared its head after the 2013 leak of the Department of Justice white paper that describes circumstances under which the president can order the targeted killing of U.S. citizens. There had been little public concern in the United States about drone strikes killing people in other countries. But when it was revealed that U.S. citizens might be targeted, Americans were outraged. This was exemplified by Senator Rand Paul's 13-hour filibuster of John Brennan's nomination for CIA director. It is this double standard that motivated Nobel Peace Prize winner Archbishop Desmond Tutu to write in the New York Times, which Bill mentioned, "Do the United States and its people really want to tell those of us who live in the rest of the world that our lives are not of the same value as yours?" And when I read that letter in the New York Times, I said to myself, I would love Archbishop Tutu to write the foreword to this book. And he graciously agreed, and he elaborates on that thought in his foreword. A new whistleblower has joined the ranks of Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, John Kiriakou, and other courageous individuals. The unnamed person, who chose to remain anonymous because of the Obama administration's unprecedented and vigorous prosecution of whistleblowers, is a member of the intelligence community. In the belief that the American public has the right to know about the fundamentally and morally flawed U.S. drone program, this source provided The Intercept with a treasure trove of secret military documents and slides that shine a critical light on the country's killer drone program. These files confirm that the Obama administration's policy and practice of assassination using armed drones and other methods violate the law. The documents reveal the kill chain that describes who will be targeted, that decides who will be targeted. As the source said, this outrageous explosion of watch listing, of monitoring people and racking and stacking them on lists, assigning them numbers, assigning them baseball cards, assigning them death sentences without notice on a worldwide battlefield, it was, from the very first instance, wrong. These secret documents demonstrate that the administration kills innumerable civilians due to its reliance on signals intelligence in undeclared war zones, as I said, following cell phones or computers that may or may not be carried by suspected terrorists. And the documents show that more than half the intelligence used to locate potential targets in Somalia and Yemen was based on this method. It isn't a surefire method. You're relying on the fact that you have these all-powerful machines capable of collecting extraordinary amounts of data and intelligence, which can cause those involved to think they possess godlike powers, according to the source. It is stunning the number of instances when selectors are misattributed to certain people. And he characterized a missile fired at a target in a group of people as a leap of faith. The administration's practice of minimizing civilian casualties is exaggerating at best, if not outright lies, according to the source. From January 2012 to February 2013, a campaign called Operation Haymaker was carried out in the Afghan provinces of Kunar and Nuristan. According to these drone papers, during a five-month period, almost 90% of the people killed in airstrikes were not the intended targets. This campaign paralleled an increase in drone attacks and civilian casualties throughout Afghanistan. What's more, the campaign did not significantly degrade al-Qaeda's operations there, according to the source. Obama's preference for killing instead of apprehension, according to the source, actually prevents the administration from gathering critical intelligence. Obama stated in 2013, America does not take strikes when we have the ability to capture individual terrorists. Our preference is always to detain, interrogate, and prosecute. But Michael Flynn, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, told The Intercept, "We don't capture people anymore." Unquote. Slides provided by the drone paper source cite a 2013 study by the Pentagon's Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Task Force that said kill operations significantly reduce the intelligence available from detainees and captured material. So the task force recommended capture and interrogation rather than killing in drone strikes. The American public is largely unaware of the high number of civilian casualties from drone strikes. A study conducted by American University professor Jeff Bachman concluded that both the New York Times and the Washington Post substantially underrepresented the number of civilians killed in drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen, failed to correct the public record when evidence emerged that the reporting was wrong, and ignored the importance of international law. Gregory McNeil, an expert on national security and drones at Pepperdine, wrote that in Afghanistan and Iraq, when collateral damage, that is civilian casualties, did occur, 70% of the time it was attributed to failed, that is mistaken, identifications. Anyone caught in the vicinity is guilty by association, the drone paper source notes. If a drone attack kills more than one person, there is no guarantee that those persons deserved their fate. So it's a phenomenal gamble. Drone strikes are Obama's weapon of choice because they don't result in U.S. casualties. It is the politically advantageous thing to do. Low cost, no U.S. casualties, gives the appearance of toughness, according to former Director of National Intelligence Dennis Blair. It plays well domestically, and it's unpopular only in other countries. And the damage it does to the national interest only shows up over the long term. Part of the damage, as Flynn pointed out, is that drones make the fallen into martyrs. They create a new reason to fight us even harder. The United Nations Charter's mandate for peaceful resolution of disputes and prohibition of military force, except in self-defense, is not a pipe dream. A study by the RAND Corporation concluded that between 1968 and 2006, 43% of incidents involving terrorist groups ended by a peaceful political resolution with their government. 40% were penetrated and eliminated by local police and intelligence agencies, and only 7% were ended by the use of military force. Nevertheless, the Wall Street Journal reported that the military plans to increase drone flights by 50% by 2019. In describing how the special operations community views the prospective targets for assassination by drones, the Drone Papers source said, "They have no rights. They have no dignity. They have no humanity to themselves. They're just a selector to an analyst. You eventually get to a point in the target's life cycle that you're following them. You don't even refer to them by the actual name. This results in dehumanizing the people before you've even encountered the moral question of, is this legitimate or not?" Many drone pilots, as I said, suffer from PTSD. Some are refusing to fly the drones. Last September, the Air Force Times ran a historic ad paid for by 54 U.S. veterans and vets organizations urging Air Force drone operators and other military personnel to refuse orders to fly drone surveillance and attack missions. I just want to briefly, in the couple of minutes that I have, this reminds me of the O.J. Simpson trial. I don't know if you remember, Judge Ito had a whole collection of hourglasses. I wrote a book on cameras in the courtroom from that, and this is what this reminds me of. I don't know if you ever used them, though. So the collection that I put together is an interdisciplinary collection of human rights and political activists, policy analysts, lawyers, and legal scholars, a philosopher, a journalist, and a sociologist that examine different aspects of the U.S. policy of targeted killing by drones and other methods. And the contributors explore the legality, morality, and geopolitical considerations and evaluate the impact on relations between the United States and the countries affected by the targeted killings. Drones and targeted killings will not solve the problem of terrorism. If you use the drone and the selected killings and do nothing on the other side, then you get rid of individuals. But the root causes are still there, former Somali Foreign Minister Ismail Mahmoud Houri told Jeremy Scahill. The root causes are not security. The root causes are political and economic. A Pentagon study conducted during the Bush administration, this is the Bush administration's Pentagon, concluded, "Muslims do not hate our freedom, but rather they hate our policies." It identified, this is the Pentagon study under Bush, American direct intervention in the Muslim world through the United States' one-sided support in favor of Israel, support for Islamic tyrannical regimes in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and primarily the American occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. These policies, which are rationalized to stop terrorism, paradoxically elevate the stature of and support for Islamic radicals. Becker and Shane sounded an alarm about the ramification of drone strikes on the future of U.S. relations with Muslim countries. They noted, "Obama's focus on strikes has made it impossible to forge, for now, the new relationship with the Muslim world that he had envisioned. Both Pakistan and Yemen are arguably less stable and more hostile to the United States than when Mr. Obama became president. Justly or not, drones have become the provocative symbol of American power, running roughshod over national sovereignty and killing innocents. We ignore this admonition at our peril. Until we stop invading other countries with Muslim populations, occupying their lands, torturing their people, and killing them with drones, we will never be safe from terrorism." Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cohn, for a really marvelous presentation. The book is just as fascinating. I mean, it's the details, the examples given, really drive home this whole problem of drones, the legal implications, the moral implications, but also the human implications, this whole thing of collateral damage. You know, your mother, your sister, your aunt, your uncle, you know, just being collateral damage because they're shooting at you, but these other people get that too. So it's really very problematic. But I want to now open the floor for questions and comments that you may have. Wait for the mic. Raise your hand. Wait for the mic to come to you, and then you can address Ms. Cohn with your comments. Thank you so much for your question.
Thank you so much for a great overview. I have a very specific question that you may or may not be able to address, but I'm doing a lot of research on the notion of moral injury, the PTSD, the what happens to those that we put in positions of killing. And it was different in World War II, for example, when it was very visceral, different on the ground. It's taken a different shape and form, this objectification of people and then killing them. I wonder if you've touched upon that at all or can talk about that, how this different way of doing something it maybe shapes the pilots differently or, you know, the impact on the pilots who are asked to do this.
Yes. There is one of the chapters is written by a philosopher, Harry van der Linden, who is a professor at Butler. And he talks about things like during wartime, and we're talking about active war, not these drone wars that Obama has basically declared the entire war a battlefield, entire world a battlefield. But the surveillance platform where the drones, the surveillance drones are watching people's lives, people intimately, day and night, and then also the concept of the sleeping soldier. Do you kill somebody while they're sleeping? Is that moral? The issue of the PTSD on the drone pilots. You know, you have these people who are not at any risk themselves. And that's one of the reasons that Obama likes them, because we learned, the U.S. government learned during the Vietnam War, and I am a child of the Vietnam anti-war movement, and I suspect some of you are as well. Mm-hmm. Americans don't like to see Americans coming back in body bags, and that really creates opposition to what the U.S. is doing. So if we can kill people, the bad guys, the militants, the suspected militants, without endangering our pilots, then that's preferable. And that's why Obama is using drones on such a widespread basis. And so the pilots are not at any physical risk. They put on their flight suits. They go into these trailers out in the desert. I'm going to a Stop the Drone Week outside of Las Vegas in a couple of weeks, Creech Air Force Base, which is where a lot of these pilots are based that control the drones. But when they and the technology is so incredible that they can see the faces of the people that are about to be killed, and they can see the faces of these people over a long period of time, because these drones can stay up in the air about 22 hours at a time without having to refuel. So they can see these people going about their lives, taking care of their children and their animals and eating and drinking and sleeping, etc. And then they press a button that blows them away, and many times blows away clearly civilians, women and children. There's not even an argument that in most instances that they're combatants. And that takes its toll psychologically on drone pilots. There were four former drone pilots who came out with a public letter to Obama in the last few months urging him to reconsider this drone program, and we saw almost nothing about it in the corporate media. They really squelched it. But drone pilots, they're having trouble getting drone pilots. They are offering bonuses to get people to become drone pilots because of this PTSD.
Bob?
Thank you, Bill. If the drones stop tomorrow, is the legal community in our nation and internationally working on developing an effective international legal infrastructure to deal with non-state actors mm-hmm. planning terrorism and state actors committing gross humanitarian violations, you know, slaughtering people in their country? Is the legal community working to create that kind of international legal infrastructure?
We have laws that govern off the battlefield killings, and they come from our Constitution, and it's called due process. And so if someone is suspected of committing a crime, they are arrested, they're given a full hearing, and they go to trial. When you're off the battlefield, the law enforcement model is what is used, which means that if there's an imminent threat of the use of violence, then action can be taken, police action can be taken. But unfortunately, our leaders, and this is the Obama administration and the Bush administration and Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State, who has vowed to continue this policy. In fact, she's even more hawkish than Obama is in many ways. I can give you examples of that. Use military force as a first resort, not a last resort. And in fact, she has advocated a no-strike zone over Syria, and which until Russia mysteriously pulled their planes out, would have actually shot down Russian planes. And the preference for diplomacy, for including all of the players in the region, and that includes Russia and that includes Iran, vicious Iran who has threatened no one, as far as I know, and doesn't have nuclear weapons, has not been fully explored. So the UN Charter is very clear that military force is a last resort and only in self-defense or when the Security Council agrees. And the UN Charter specifically says that negotiation, mediation, arbitration should be used. Also, if you look at the macro picture and you wonder why are people doing us harm or other people, we're not directly victimized, although on 9/11, it's interesting, after 9/11, before Osama bin Laden took responsibility for it, I suspected he was behind it. And so shortly after 9/11, I asked myself, how could 19 men, 15 of whom, by the way, came from Saudi Arabia, none of them came from Afghanistan, how could 19 men commit suicide and take 3,000 innocents with them? And so I did some research on Osama bin Laden, and of course I'm no fan of Osama bin Laden, but there were three things that Osama bin Laden pointed to, three things that really infuriated him about the United States. First was the presence of what he called the Western infidels, the U.S. troops, in Saudi Arabia, in the holy sites of Islam, Mecca and Medina. Second was the killing of 1 million people in Iraq during the 90s under Bill Clinton, half of them children. And the third was Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. Those were the three things that really, really incensed him. And so if we really want to be safe from terrorism, rather than using these Band-Aid use of force, drone strikes, manned bombers, killing people on this incredible level, we need to completely do an analysis, a reanalysis of our foreign policy. Where are we invading? What countries are we occupying? I would recommend to you a book. It's a comic book. It's called Addicted to War. It's put out by Veterans for Peace. It's this big and thin, and it's illustrated. It's a tremendous resource. All of the armed invasions the U.S. has undertaken from the beginning, almost all of them, to protect corporate interests. No surprise there, I suppose.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Is this on?
Yes. Yeah.
So while I agree that war is atrocious and war inevitably means that we objectify other people because that's the only way we as decent human beings can find our way into killing, I am a little unclear about what it is specifically that you object to. For one thing, U.S. law is not extraterritorially applicable to non-residents abroad, so the legal arguments don't strike me as particularly persuasive. The law of war is a discrete area of law, as I'm sure you know, independent of our treaties, which over history have never constrained us as warriors. I'm not suggesting that they should not, but they have not. And if the final argument is that, in effect, we're turning our service people into murderers because the theater of war has become so extenuated, then I would have to say our people, our country, has decided that we are at war and that our theaters have necessarily extended. So it seems to me that this comes down to the fact that we have not updated either our treaties, our laws, or our understandings of the laws of war, so that it incorporates the kind of behavior that you're so concerned about. So would you address that?
First of all, I would not say yes. War is atrocious, but I am not a pacifist. War can be used not as an instrument of foreign policy, which is the way the United States uses it, which is what is prohibited by the UN Charter. But in self-defense, wars of national liberation are also, I think, just wars. Our Constitution has what is called the Due Process Clause. It's not limited to U.S. citizens. It says no person, the government shall not deny any person. You're shaking your head, but you know that this is true. Yes, well, you know that. Well, other people may not know that, so I want to point that out. The Due Process Clause does not just apply to U.S. citizens. It says that the government shall not deprive any person of due process of law, and it has been interpreted not just to apply to U.S. citizens. Our treaties are fine. If we followed them, then we would be following the law. We are a nation of laws. If we're not following them, that doesn't mean they should be changed. That means that we should be following the law. And the law of war, as you know, is contained in the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Regulations. And the Geneva Convention says civilians shall not be targeted. The number of civilian casualties cannot be disproportionate to the military advantage sought. And that the military has the duty to distinguish, it's called the principle of distinction, between combatants and civilians. The United States has 800 military bases around the world. 800 military bases. Why do we need all these military bases? What are we doing there? Whose interests are we protecting? And so rather than amending our treaties, which we don't follow anyway, perhaps we should change our policy, which means changing our priorities, which means, and I'm surprised that Bernie Sanders hasn't talked about this more. He talked about it in his 1997 book or 1996 book, taking some of that money from the bloated military budget and putting it into universal health care, free education, etc.
Virginia Rovniak?
I have a couple of questions. First is very short. Are any other countries or entities deploying and using killer drones? And the second is, whenever there's a new weapon, then the arms people get real busy in figuring out how to defend against them. So it seems, are you aware that our military or other militaries are developing anti-drone weapons? I think it's only a matter of time before we start, you know, people start shooting them down, and then you get their missiles and anti-missiles, and then their anti-missiles, and, you know, to get going on this type of weapon, it's not going to last forever.
Right. Israel is using killer drones against people in Gaza. In fact, Israel developed killer drones. The United States is now selling drone technology to our allies. The difficulty and the danger is that our allies today become our enemies tomorrow, and there's nothing to say that this technology is not going to get into the hands of people who would do us harm. Drones fly very, very low. Be very easy to shoot them down. But the terrorists that we're trying to take out don't have air forces. So you wonder why we're building up this bloated military as if we're still, you know, fighting the Cold War when it's a very different situation. So yes, it is. It's not difficult to shoot down the drones, but the bad guys that we're trying to take out don't have air forces yet.
Okay. This is on? Okay, thank you. Well, thank you for coming to talk on this important topic. It's kind of an interesting thing. You mentioned the kill chain, and you know, someone had spoken about PTSD in remote drone pilots and that sort of thing. And there's an interesting solution to this that's been posed recently. Apparently, on the 3rd of this month, there's a deputy assistant secretary that's in charge of procurement, logistics, and robotics at the Department of Defense that had spoken to Defense Convention saying that it should be on the table to have autonomous targeting, meaning you talk about targeted killing. And so it's I think the legal, I'm not a lawyer, but I think a lot of the legal arguments for what's happening now in terms of remote killing is that there's still a human being, a soldier at the end making the decision whether to kill or not to kill. Then they push the joystick button and then it happens. Apparently, I assume then that there is actually a framework that's going to justify autonomous killing machines. Basically, Terminators or RoboCop or whatever, however you want to talk about it. But I just found this really fascinating, and I guess it would solve the problem of PTSD in drone pilots. But I was wondering if you guys could talk about that a little bit.
Yes, that's also addressed in the book. They're called LARS, Lethal Automated Robot Systems, where no individual decides who, when, and where to kill. It's made completely by computer. The UN is very, very concerned about this, and the special rapporteurs have written reports advocating a suspension of the LARS and actually prohibition of the LARS. It's frightening. It's really, really, it's even more frightening than when pilots are deciding who to kill and they make so many mistakes. So this is where the technology is headed. They have not been used yet. They are on the drawing board and likely will be used in the future unless there is a groundswell opposing their use. But that is even more frightening than what we have now. Glad you brought it up.
I had a quick question about the drone program's relation to the War Powers Act. Mm-hmm. Most people assume that, you know, the drone program is just an instrument of fighting the war on terror. So where does the Obama administration get its legal justification to use the drone program if it's an instrument of war, and how does it supersede the War Powers Resolution?
Right. The War Powers Resolution was passed in 1973 in response to the Vietnam War, saying that if a U.S. president puts U.S. forces into active hostilities and he or she has to report within 60 days to Congress. And although Obama technically complies with that, he uses the AUMF, Authorization for Use of Military Force, that I described as a legal basis. Now, besides the fact that that doesn't apply to al-Shabaab and groups that were not associated with al-Qaeda, that particular AUMF, and he has tried to get Congress to give him an updated AUMF, we're still bound by the UN Charter. We are still bound by the Geneva Conventions. We're still bound by the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Those treaties are part of U.S. law, domestic law, under the Supremacy Clause. So even if we had an updated AUMF, that still would not make these illegal drone strikes legal.
You know, one of the things that really gets to me is you can talk about the legal constraints when they actually apply. But the problem is, and there are many chapters in this book that talk about the way in which we get around those things, the way in which the people who use the drones and who engage in targeted killing will do all sorts of things to sort of keep the killing anonymous and things like that. But the thing that really gets to me is the thing that we learn in Sunday school. You know, we talk about war and we talk about just wars. And there's a very good chapter here about, you know, what makes a just war, you know, as proposed by St. Ambrose and St. Augustine. But there's no just war when you look at the way we use drones. And the question I have is, you know, how can you do, can we do unto others as we'd have them do unto us? What would happen to us if somebody didn't like our stance, our politics, and then targeted us with drones and killed our uncle, our aunt, our friends, when they're trying to get us, even when there's not been any due process to show that I'm really guilty of the thing for which you're trying to target me? And I think that's why Archbishop Tutu's statement is so powerful. Because you say, we are doing this to people out there. But what would happen if they did it to us? If the same thing were being done to us? Are there any other questions?
Other questions?
Yeah.
One more.
It was very hard to listen to this for me, for one thing. I'm an Obama supporter. I'm a Democrat. A lot of looking at the whole picture, I guess I would say a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. I had no idea that you could see the faces of people with a drone. I had a tiny amount of knowledge about drones. That's why I came here. Is to learn, and to learn what the rest of the world is doing, what the Security Council is doing. So, you know, I wish that if there were another session, there could be less reading of quotes and more stimulating points, say in a PowerPoint or handout, you could have these, and get people talking about moral, legal, whatever. More time talking about it, more time analyzing alternatives, looking at the world view, because a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And I feel I'm learning about this, but I'm very troubled by it. And I'd like to know more what we can do, what you think all of us can do about these things, rather than just increase our knowledge.
Yes, let me respond to that. In a democracy, it is the responsibility of the citizens to speak out when the government is breaking the law, is doing things in their name that are not right. And so one thing, I mean, our government is, certainly the Congress is quite dysfunctional at the moment, but these congresspersons do respond to pressure. They respond to pressure from their constituents, which means that it's incumbent upon us to contact our representatives in any way we can, by email, by letters, by sitting in their offices, by demonstrating and telling them that we do not approve of this program that is continuing in our name. It means writing op-eds in the newspaper. It means writing letters to the editor. Letters to the editor are not difficult to get published. You peg them to a particular news story or an editorial, keep them under 150 words, and even if your letter doesn't get in, they count the number of letters from a particular perspective, and they will publish letters from that perspective. So it means demonstrating, it means First Amendment protected activity, it means going to the drone base, Hancock drone base, and protesting in upstate New York. It means going to outside, I know it's not convenient, but if you have the opportunity, going to Creech Air Force Base where the drones take off outside of Las Vegas. It means working in any way you can, organizing and pressuring the government. That's the only way that this is going to stop.
Well, I think that is a wonderful question and a comment to end our discussion, because again, Before I read this book, I mean, I'd gotten another book on drones, and I hadn't, you know, there are drones of things that are going on out there. Somebody else is doing it. It doesn't affect me. But then when you say, what are we doing with these drones? What is happening? And what is being done in our name? You know? And then you see how horrible, as Dr. Cohn said in her first chapter, these are a dark new weapon of war. You know, it's a dark weapon. And we really need to realize this, how dark these things are. Thank you so much for coming. And thank you so much for your questions and your comments. And I do hope that you'll get this book. We've got copies up here that you can buy. And please fill out the evaluation form and say what you thought about this thing, because as I said, this will strengthen the Festival of the Book. And please line up if you want to get your book autographed by Dr. Cohn. Thank you.